This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. 67 games are being played in Indianapolis as part of March Madness, the annual men's college basketball tournament. Pre-COVID, this would have been quite a feat, but now there are so many other factors to consider when planning such a large-scale event in the midst of a global pandemic. With us now to discuss more about just how unusual this all is Samantha Horton, business reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Samantha.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out with this question that I think a lot of people are wondering. Have we ever seen the March Madness tournament played entirely in one city?
That's a great question. And I, from what I've gathered, it's making history in itself since the March Madness has become what it's become in 1939, I believe. So this is brand new. I mean, you're talking about 68 teams. You mentioned 67 games over the course of 3 weeks. This is a major logistical lift that had to be accomplished to make this happen.
Can you take us a little bit back to the before times? You know, how was this tournament usually held?
Yeah, so this tournament was maybe held, it was held in many locations across the country. I mean, I believe Indianapolis has been used on a regular basis to host a part of March Madness, but not to this, obviously, to this level. I mean, last year it was scheduled to host the Elite Eight, Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, but that was canceled. But I mean, it's a rotation usually, and it's spread across the country. So it gives a lot of different parts of the U.S. a chance to highlight their communities and get a little economic boost possibly. So that's the one downside this year for communities maybe that were looking forward to hosting a portion of March Madness, is they don't necessarily get to see that.
Do you know, was there any sort of discussions with other cities that were like, no, it's not fair, you're going to take all of the business here? And I guess, how did Indianapolis end up being the spot?
So yeah, that's good questions. And I know at least in January, when it was announced that it was all going to be held in one location, I know there was a lot of conversation about what does that mean for the communities maybe that were planning to host a part of it. And a lot of the conversation was NCAA will be working with those locations to try to make sure that they are able to be used in the next few years and utilized. I know there's usually about six locations, and Indianapolis is one of those that are rotated on a regular basis for games. Indianapolis is already set to host the Final Four this year. So that was, I believe, a factor, as well as the fact that NCAA is headquartered here in Indianapolis. So there's a lot of connections between the organization and the state.
So it definitely helps to have those connections. When we think of sporting events and we think of people and all the people that are going to be around, you know, there are definitely needs that are going to be need to be met, like food, a place to stay, people from out of town. Let's talk a little bit about the logistics of this all. How is this being handled with respect to the teams coming to Indy? Where are they staying?
Yeah, and I think there's so much in logistics. So I'm glad we're just talking about teams right now. Right now the teams overall 68 were held in about four hotels. Those hotels, it's dwindling down as the games go on, where one hotel will host like the Final Four, and slowly the other ones will be able to open up to, you know, people maybe coming into town for the games. But it has been a controlled environment, is how the NCAA has described it. It's all connected with the convention center, which is connected with Lucas Oil Stadium. So it's kind of idea of like really not bringing the athletes to exposure from the outside, keeping them inside as much as they can in this controlled environment, with exception to some of the locations having to travel by bus to some of the sites. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they have practice courts, they have weight room areas, they have conference meeting rooms. I mean, it's a whole logistical, I mean, they have everything down to time with like when teams mm-hmm. will leave, so teams don't come into contact with each other unless they're playing a game. So I mean, it's right. Very, very controlled.
And so I guess that gets to the next question I wanted to talk about, which is the safety measures that are in place for the players and the staff. You're mentioning there's different times when they come and go, but what other implementations are put in place?
Yeah, I mean, regular COVID-19 testing. I mean, we saw that recently with one team who like was unable to play because they just had cases and they weren't able to make a team to be able to play in the game. So, I mean, it's obviously that's being watched. They have a designated like person or people that are going to get the meals, even so far as just in the hotel lobby. So, I mean, it's very, mm-hmm. I mean, it's very limited on who comes in contact with what. And it's even the hotel staff are like the ones who come into contact with anyone with the team have to be having rapid COVID tests for those mm-hmm. employees. And then all the other employees are still getting screened with like temperature checks and forms, maybe saying like, have they had any COVID symptoms in the past period of time? Mm-hmm.
Did you come across any sort of challenges that have been discovered while trying to plan for this, or has it been smooth sailing the whole time?
I mean, there's obviously going to be challenges. I mean, as you know, there's plans in place for when those challenges arise. I think that's kind of the key is like, you know, if there is like a COVID cases that are found with team members or there's the contact tracing set in place to be like, okay, who was in like close parameter with that person for how much time, or, you know, like that idea of just like really being able to target that. I think that's kind of the mm-hmm. idea, I guess. There's going to be challenges, I think, but I think there's been kind of those steps of then what do we do next?
And from a business angle, I know you've been covering this a lot. What have you learned talking to business owners in the area who've been preparing for this? Is this a good thing for them? Are they excited?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think excited is like not enough to express like how these businesses have felt. I mean, looking at the hospitality industry alone, it's been a rough year with the pandemic. It's been a hard year. I mean, I remember when I talked to the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association described like for hotels and alone in the state, like about 95% of the employees were laid off or furloughed over the course of 48 hours about a year ago. So, I mean, this is a big deal for a lot of people who maybe haven't got a chance to work as much, and it's exciting. But I mean, the flip side is I've talked to some workers, you know, who maybe are a little more apprehensive because maybe they have a pre-existing condition. So there's a balance sometimes of like the idea of like, mm-hmm. this is really great financial like boost for a lot of people, but also that like, you know, for some, it might be come with some risks.
Right. Right. And you spoke a little bit about the hotels. Have you heard anything talking to people at the Marriott downtown?
Yeah. So I actually went, that's where I actually met with a worker and the manager as well. And I know Ashley, the worker, she had been furloughed. And so like, I mean, this wasn't her first time back necessarily. It was not necessarily due to March Madness, but it was definitely like giving her some more hours to work. And she looked forward to it. She's a single mom. So, I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, this is welcome news to a lot of people in an industry that's just not expected to fully recover either within this year or so.
Right, right. And as far as fans coming in to watch, where are they coming from? Do you know, are they coming from around the country? Are they just local?
Oh, yeah. I went downtown a little bit this weekend and yesterday as well to kind of just see, you know, how, you know, fans, like where they're from possibly, and all over the country. I mean, when you bring in teams that represent different parts of the country coming here, you have those people who support, and it's sometimes it's family members too of some of the athletes. So it's not just necessarily fans all the way, but I mean, it's a variety of people all coming to Indianapolis this year to support their team or their athlete that they, you know, are family to. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you as a reporter to just be able to go out and see people? The rest of us are stuck inside, but I mean, how was that?
It's definitely kind of one of those things where after a year of, you know, seeing a lot of maybe less activity downtown, it's very kind of like that stark contrast to describe it. I mean, there is the risk, I know, of people saw some of the photos from this weekend of like at Bottle Works with people watching the game that it was a lot of people without masks on. And there was a lot of concern of kind of where we're, and we're going to probably talk about this a little bit too, is that public health element of, you know, concern of, you know, try to not have a super spreader event. So, I mean, that's kind of the balance there is, you know, like people are excited to be out. It was good weather as well. So, I mean, everyone wants to enjoy the sun after a winter. So, yeah, I think it was different. I mean, it's definitely people are here and people are excited to be able to go see a sporting event.
So it almost seems to see just people out and about as a bit of a morale booster overall. Are there any estimates right now on the economic impact this event could have on Indianapolis?
Yeah, so I don't believe there's ever like been an official analysis from what I can tell. I know at least in early January when the announcement was made, some of us reporters were asking about that. And at least that was prior to fans I know it was already like over $100,000 economic impact. It was already substantial just with the teams alone. Thousands of dollars at least. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a substantial amount of money already there alone. But I mean, with fans, that just adds, that's only going to increase that number.
Right. And some of the businesses that you talked to, were they already seeing like immediate differences in the income coming in, or even just, you mentioned even these hotels are starting to be able to hire people back. Was it that drastic of a difference?
Yeah. I mean, some businesses I know were still like trying to hire extra people to just meet the demand that they saw coming here. I mean, I saw lines outside restaurants, you know, where people were waiting to go in because of the capacity limits. So, I mean, yeah, it's definitely, people are ready to be here, whether it's, you know, just enjoying the weather or to be at the sporting event for March Madness. That's been both those things. Mm-hmm.
And is there anything that surprised you while covering this at all? Anything that jumped out at you in terms of just this weird world that we're in, where it's COVID, but then we're doing events, but then some people aren't able to get out? I mean, how was that?
So I think one of the big things, just I guess to kind of wrap it up as I'm leaving it, is something that some have raised concern about a little bit is, and talking about from a public health standpoint, the fact that there isn't necessarily a robust contact tracing system in place. So, for example, if someone from, I'm just picking random states, but like Iowa, then someone from like Virginia, both come to Indy and they both go back home, and like the one in Iowa tests positive for COVID, there's not necessarily a system in place that the person in Virginia would ever know, like, I was in contact possibly with this person. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's a huge thing. But like, those are kind of things where it's kind of right now, like, how do we, for the public health standpoint, navigate this?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Samantha Horton, business reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. After a quick break, we'll hear more on the logistics and planning that went into pulling off March Madness in Indianapolis. Again, it's not just the Final Four, but the entire tournament, about 67 games that are all being played here in the state. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about March Madness, the college men's basketball tournament happening entirely in Indianapolis this year. It's quite a challenge to put on the Final Four, let alone dozens of games. So why was this decision made? And how does it all work out in the end? With us now is Ryan Vaughn, president of Indiana Sports Corps. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Miriam.
So I guess the big question we all are dying to know the answer to is, what is the secret that Indianapolis has that they were able to get the tournament here for the entire duration?
Well, Indianapolis and the NCAA have a long partnership. You know, the NCAA relocated here in the late 1990s, I think maybe even cut the ribbon in 2000. And so we have a rich working history. We've hosted 8 Final Fours. We've hosted 3 women's Final Fours. Typically every year we host some round of the men's tournaments. And that's to say nothing of the other championships that we host across the state for the NCAA. So we have a longstanding relationship of executing men's basketball events that certainly went in our favor as we were evaluating this opportunity. It helps, too, of course, that the NCAA is located here, and we were already scheduled to host the Final Four. But at the end of the day, and the NCAA would speak to this more clearly, I really think it was just about the relationship and the trust and the partnership to be able to execute mm-hmm. it effectively.
Is there anything about the city that makes it easy to pull off a tournament of this size, aside from the relationship with NCAA? But I don't know, are there more stadiums or more playing space or more hotels?
Yeah, the physical construction of downtown Indy is quite literally on purpose and historically built to host major events. So we do have a number of hotels that are connected via skywalk to the convention center where the key practice areas are. And, in a pandemic, they're actually quite easy to secure, and players, coaches, and staff can safely move without sort of interacting with the general public. And so that was a sort of a key dynamic, I'm sure, in making the decision. Additionally, we have a number of just historic basketball venues that are in close proximity. So transporting teams to you know, whether it's Mackey or Assembly Hall in Lafayette and Bloomington, respectively, you know, those are, you know, within 90 minutes of a bus drive. And then, of course, we've got Hinkle Fieldhouse, the Coliseum, Bankers Life Fieldhouse. And for the first time ever, we built two courts inside of Lucas Oil Stadium. And all of those, if you're familiar with downtown Indy, are literally within minutes of one another. So logistically, you know, we had all the tools necessary to execute. Then, of course, that, you know, rich history I spoke about played a key role as well.
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned at the top that you're with Indiana Sports Corps. What is the role that you're playing with planning this whole tournament?
Yeah, our mission at Indiana Sports Corp is to advance and inspire our community through sports. And what that practically means is that we are the institution that sort of assembles the community effort to go and compete for the right to host major sporting events. We want, you know, the Final Fours, the Super Bowls, the NBA All-Star Games of the world to choose Indianapolis as the place that they host their championship or premier events. If we're fortunate enough to be selected, we then on the back end serve as the organization which fulfills really kind of all the logistical needs to make it successful. We form what's called a local organizing committee. This is a committee of community volunteers who tackle a variety of different topics which are essential to execute an event, whether it's recruiting volunteers, PR and media, you know, police escorts and VIPs, working with our airport. In this instance, there were some unique things that we needed to solve for, like how do we get food from our restaurants to inside the hotel? How do we service the needs of people who can't leave necessarily the controlled environment, but have items that they need, especially if they're going to be here for some time. So it's really a Herculean effort. Our local organizing committee has, you know, just over 300 people volunteering in it. And those are really key organizers. On top of that, we have about 2,000 people who have picked up volunteer shifts to help us execute.
You mentioned the logistics and food, and I love food, so let's talk about that. How are you able to get food to players that are, I feel like they're sequestered in these places, you know, almost like jury members, like they can't leave or maybe they're not supposed to leave. How do you get things to them and keep this, I guess, the health protocols in place?
Yeah, it's been an interesting process, which has come together quite quickly and with a lot of help from the NCAA at the health departments and the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association. In essence, what we had was the NCAA and the health department tell us under what circumstances could food be prepared and delivered. We then took those criteria to the Indiana Restaurant Lodging Association and said, hey, can you reach out to your memberships and figure out if they can do these things? And if so, who? And then we will put them on a preferred list. So in essence, we published some requirements to our restaurants. We had about 85 different restaurants that said, yes, we can do individual packaging. Yes, we can label them, you know, as required. Yes, we have a delivery service. And once they met all that criteria, we then took feedback from the restaurants themselves and said, okay, in order to execute that, what do you need from the players or the coaches who are making the order, such as, do you need a 2-hour lead time or do you need a 24-hour lead time? And so it was a lot of back and forth, but we've built a pretty robust and successful restaurant program. Like I said, we have about 85 restaurants participating. And we've had, you know, practically what ends up happening is they put their order in, they're prepared separately, packaged separately, labeled, delivered to the hotel. And each hotel has a bit of a, what I'll call a buffer area, where you kind of walk in, drop stuff off. And then there's another set of doors where someone who is living in the controlled environment after the delivery person leaves, walks in, picks up the meals and shares them according to who ordered what. So it's working pretty well.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of things to keep in mind and keep that train rolling. We've heard about, you know, other games that were held, like the Super Bowl and things like that. And were you taking any examples out of what they were able to accomplish and applying it here? Or have you been able to sort of create your own format?
A little bit of both. Certainly there were considerable learnings from the NBA bubble in Orlando, what we saw with the Super Bowl, MLS, MLB. You know, most of the professional leagues have had some element of a controlled environment, whether it was a full-on bubble or something less than. And we measured the successes there, and the NCAA has done a fantastic job learning from those. We also were very aggressive early on in the fall in creating our own controlled environment. We, Indiana Sports Corp, built basketball courts, competition and practice inside the convention center. And we started hosting a number of events on a much, much smaller scale to sort of learn as we were going how to do these things safely and logistically smooth. So it's been a combination of both, but so far it's been very effective.
I don't know if you'd be able to touch upon, I know in the first segment, our reporter mentioned the team that tested positive that had to drop out of the game. I mean, do you have any insight into how something like that would happen with all of these controls in place and everyone bubbled up? What happened there?
Yeah, I don't have specific knowledge on it, but, you know, the players were required to test, obviously, before heading into the bubble or the controlled environment, and then they're being tested daily while they're in the environment. So I would be speculating, but I would guess a player or players contracted or were exposed to the virus prior to entering the controlled environment, but that not yet sufficiently along their infection to test positive. And so and that seems to be what the team BCU is saying publicly, is they believe they had some contact at their conference tournament immediately prior to entering the environment itself. So, but you know, the protocols in place caught it before they had a competition. It's very unfortunate for those student athletes. They weren't very able to participate, but thus far the protocols put in place by the NCAA and health department have been effective and allowed the vast majority, all but one game to take place safely.
Mm-hmm. And has your group been able to work on these safety measures, planning around this, and what to do in a situation like that?
Yeah, it's really the NCAA's decision to make as it relates to teams, coaches, and staff. Outside of the controlled environment, and by that I mean sort of outside of the hotels and the convention center, there are other environmental factors and safety precautions that are taking place at each venue as well, right? So security guards, ushers, essential personnel for executing games, all going through their own separate regimen of testing and monitoring as well. And so a lot of that responsibility is organizationally has fallen upon us to help execute. But, you know, we feel really good about where we're at. And we learned a lot, like I mentioned, from engaging in that activity, you know, in the early fall as well.
And I mean, this is such a huge event. It's never been done like this before. And adding a pandemic on top of that, what are some of the biggest challenges you've faced in trying to get everything to come together, or has it just been perfect?
It has been far from, you know, normally we would have, you know, every bit of 18 months to plan something like this. And while we had a strong sense that it was a possibility really last November, you know, planning in earnest kicked off in January. And so, you know, we've compressed 18 months of planning into really 2.5. And so that's been the biggest challenge, is just having to make a lot of decisions with less information. And it's not necessarily so on the safety side. You know, I feel like the NCAA and the state and local health departments have done a fantastic job sort of coming to their safety plan and believing it was effective and could be executed prior to the announcing. But once the announcement happens, that's when the logistics of the event kick in. You know, how do you deal with 150 charter buses in your downtown that need to be escorted, you know, to 6 different venues for practices and for games? And how do you staff up? You know, we posted on one Monday, we posted 5,000 volunteer shift opportunities. And normally we'd have a long lead time to fill those. And we had, you know, really 3 days. And God bless our volunteers for stepping up and helping us do those things. But it's really just a compressed timetable that's made it challenging.
Mm-hmm. And how do you keep track of all of these different logistics that are going on? It's reminding me of a conversation we had last week about supply chain management and just like how there's processes in place. But like condensing, you said like 18 months into 2 months and then trying to like keep track of everything, that just sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it's incredible work by a lot of our volunteers. And I'll brag on them a little bit. I just have an awesome team here at Indiana Sports Corp. I mean, we're, you know, 25 strong. Everyone is all in. They have their own specific area of professional responsibility, and they are just completely invested in executing at a high level. And so, you know, many of the programs, whether it was the host program or transportation or food delivery or, you know, or even arranging for delivery of prescriptions and things like that, mail, what have you. We've had to create from scratch, and they've done an extraordinary job, and our volunteers have also helped lead the way there. So it's been a multi-front effort. It's a what I call a typical Indianapolis story. Everyone kind of sets aside their egos and their agendas and says, we're all in, let's make it a success.
And for folks that are coming to play, these players, how long are they in town for? Let's say they make it until the end. Are they there for weeks at a time? Just to give our listeners an idea, because we think of a tournament like it's a weekend and then you go back home, but are they there for an extended period of time?
Yes, absolutely. And it varies quite a bit. You know, obviously, if let's say you were in a Pac-12 basketball conference champion and you may have arrived on a Sunday, but you also may have lost then first round, first game on a Friday. So you may have been here no more than 4 days. The flip side of that is somebody like a University of Michigan, which is currently a member of the top 16, Sweet 16. Not only have they been here the entire time of the tournament, but they also played the Big Ten men's basketball tournament here the week before that. So they've really been here since the second week of March and could stay until the second week of April. And so it's a meaningful time in Indianapolis for sure.
Mm-hmm. And with the tournament being canceled last year, and again, just going back to like how you had to condense the timeline and stuff, what gave, I guess, the NCAA or even your group confidence that this could happen this year? I mean, everything last year was just up in the air, and it seemed like nothing would come back for a while. What gave you guys the confidence that this could be pulled off?
You know, I never doubted our ability to logistically execute it. We have great partnerships throughout the community. Everyone works really well together. You know, kudos to the NCAA for having the foresight early on in early fall to kind of say, hey, if we're going to have a tournament, and we absolutely want to have a tournament for the benefit of these student athletes, we need to totally change our format, and we need to do it at a single site as it offers, you know, the best guarantee for safety. And then really just the work that they put in on the safety plan up front, the precautions they've taken, and then on the back end for us, the sort of building of the structure of the tournament and its execution. I guess it never occurred to me that we couldn't do it. It was just a matter of how much time and how hard do we need to work to make it a success.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a lot of work. Just hearing you talk about it, I mean, it's very impressive to be able to pull off this feat, I guess we could say. What about when it comes to fans and the logistics surrounding them? Is that anything you've had to deal with?
Yeah, we have had fans in multiple sporting events outside of the NCAA tournament. I mean, the Colts played with similar capacity, up to 25%. The Pacers are playing with fans. The Indy 11 played with fans. So there are some local learnings that have helped us quite a bit. And a large part of that success goes to the leadership of our Marion County Health Department, which realized that some of these things can be done and be done safely. And, you know, I tell people, and it's, I see it because I go to these games. There's a lot of environmental safety protocols in place, whether it's, you know, social distancing, manifests that are set up to keep people separated, strict enforcement of mask protocols, all kinds of infrastructure upgrades like, you know, paperless transactions and e-ticketing. You know, going to a basketball game in Lucas Oil Stadium is candidly feels far safer than it does going to the grocery store down the street sometimes, just because so much effort and energy has been put into making it a safe environment, and not only actually making it safe, but making people that come to the event feel safe, which is important as well.
Mm-hmm. And do you think any of these measures will end up sort of carrying on in the future, regardless of where we are in terms of pandemic?
I absolutely do. You know, we saw this in the world of sports, you know, with some of the security, you know, post 9/11, the expectation of the consumers that, around safety was significantly elevated, and the need to provide a safer environment was significantly elevated. Same kind of mentality here, only just around sort of viral safety, if you will. So, you know, mm-hmm. E-tickets, I think, are here to stay. You probably held your last concert ticket in your hand. It's probably all on your phone going forward. You know, paperless transactions for food and beverage, things of that nature. You know, all of the venues have pretty much been upgraded with no-touch doors that just open when you walk by as opposed to pushing them open. So there's just all kinds of, you know, millions of little things, upgrades and air, sanitation, that are all here to stay to create a safe environment.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us and giving us an inside scoop into how things are being planned and moving forward with March Madness. We appreciate your time.
No, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
And that was Ryan Vaughn, president of Indiana Sports Corps. We're talking about the March Madness in Indianapolis and how the pandemic changed the way it was held in the past in multiple cities, with all games now being played in Indianapolis. Coming up next, we'll hear from an epidemiologist about the public safety concerns some people have and whether they're justified. If you have any questions or comments, find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We've been talking about March Madness today, from the business aspect to logistical changes that made it necessary to hold all 67 games in one city. Now let's take a look at this all from another angle. There may be financial benefit and a way to keep players safe and motivated by keeping sporting events going, but what about the health and safety of everyone involved? We're joined by John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, so let's start with the most obvious question. We've been talking about this in the first two segments as well, that every single game in this tournament is happening in one city this year. Is that a good idea?
No, it's not a good idea. We're in the midst of a pandemic. And, you know, we have over nearly 550,000 Americans dead. And to be bringing people from all over the country into one city for a prolonged period of time, and then having those people, after they've been in Indiana, scatter back to their own communities, is just the wrong thing to do during a pandemic.
Now my laughter initially was just, you cut to the chase so quickly there with the no, not even room for any kind of argument here. You know, folks will say that they're doing everything that they can to put in safety measures, but you're saying that's not good enough.
No, well, let's tease out what I meant by no. You know, in terms of the basketball tournament, in terms of safety for the players, the staff, and the coaches, we've learned an enormous amount about over this year now of dealing with sports and pandemics. And basketball has really benefited from a lot of the problems we've had with Major League Baseball, with National Football League, and on the college level with college football. And so basketball has really learned a lot about how to prevent outbreaks amongst the student athletes and the staff and coaches. So I think that having March Madness occur in Indiana in reference to the students playing in the sports and the surrounding people with them, I think we know how to do it quite safely. Not 100%, of course. Nothing's 100% with this pandemic. But safety to the extent that I think it's reasonable to have the games played. That's not where my concern really is. My concern is bringing people from all over the United States to these games. And not necessarily to the games in terms of in the venues, but to your city. That's an awful lot of people that are going to be there for a prolonged period of time. And then, as I mentioned, going back to their own homes. And it's a setup for what we call super spreading events.
What would it look like to be able to have a big sporting event and fans without fear of it being a super spreader? Would it be that these fans would have to also be taking COVID tests before they enter to watch a game?
Not necessarily. You know, again, my no is tucked into my no answer is I'm not even that concerned about the fans going into the venues for the games. We've learned a lot about how to handle those fans, as the previous speaker spoke to. I think that the percentage occupancy in the games is very low, and I think that was wise. even lower in most of the venues than the 25% limit. The enforcement of masking and social distancing, if it's done correctly, will be effective. So I think even though it's not a completely safe environment for the fans, I think it's quite safe. That's not, again, where my concern lies. My concern is in all the people coming into the city who may not be going to the games, or may not be going to the games, but will be certainly staying in hotels, going to restaurants, going to bars, socializing. I think that's where the concern lies.
Were you able to compare this to other sporting events? Or, I mean, you mentioned earlier some other sporting events. Have you noticed any of them that have done this right that we could learn from? Or are there certain things that you've seen that have come up where it's like, this needs to be done a different way?
Sure. I think the model for doing it right was the NBA playoffs. They had a very strictly enforced bubble. Even though it was strictly enforced, there were still two or three breaks in it, but it really ran very smoothly. There were no games canceled, to my recollection. There were no outbreaks that occurred from it. There were also no fans who attended. So they carried it off successfully in terms of the safety for their players and coaches and staff, and they didn't risk fans in the environment and spreading it to other places. You know, it's been a little over a year. Toward the end of February of last year, in that infamous soccer game in Bergamo, Italy, while the pandemic was going on, while people knew it was a problem, although we didn't understand very much about it at that time, that soccer event alone was a super spreading event, probably greater than anything that's happened since. And it spread it throughout Europe and then ultimately to the United States. That wasn't the only reason, of course, for the spread throughout Europe. It would have happened anyway, but it was throwing kerosene on a fire. We saw other problems historically with games during the last year, particularly with college football games being canceled, some college basketball games having to be canceled, some outbreaks occurring, but not very many. With the NFL, we certainly saw games canceled and one or two teams had some outbreaks. And with Major League Baseball, we had at the beginning of the season, I recall, some games canceled. So we've stumbled, as I mentioned earlier, we've stumbled in figuring out how to do it right. And as I said, I think we've learned how to do it right for the games. I just don't think we've learned how to do it right for the fans coming into town.
And we talked a little bit about these bubbles that players are in and how, you know, that can help protect them. What about, you know, earlier we mentioned this team, I think it was Virginia Commonwealth, that had to go home because some of the players tested positive. How does that happen when people are in a bubble?
Right. Well, I think the Virginia Commonwealth example is an example of how the system worked. Because had those players in the bubble not been tested regularly, they could have represented a super spreading event to other players and to a wider swath of people. How can it happen in a bubble? It was sort of like going back to the NBA playoffs, which was far and away the perfect bubble that we could conceivably create. And yet we're dealing with human beings and we're dealing with human behavior, and human behavior never operates consistently 100% of the time how it should. And I think that's where these bubbles can break down. Again, with our testing, our robust testing that's been done, we did pick it up in time to prevent problems.
And you have been on an advisory committee that recently worked on a basketball tournament. What is it like being an epidemiologist that's trying to get non-medical field folks on board to understand, you know, the seriousness of this?
Well, you know, I'm on the Pac-12 Medical Advisory Committee. And it has been an absolute pleasure working with the other infectious disease doctors, and sports medicine doctors amongst the Pac-12. And there's been pretty much throughout my year of being on that committee, a unanimity of opinion from the medical folks of how to carry things off. And I've been really pleased with our recommendations being followed, I think 100% of the time. And in the games that led up to the Indianapolis, in the Pac-12 games that were played in Las Vegas, it was a very robust system of keeping the players and staff safe and keeping everybody else around there safe. There were no fans allowed at the games except for immediate family, which I think really improved things. And we had no problems in those games. There were no athletes, staff, or coaches who became ill or got infected. So it can be done.
Well, what about these fans who are traveling to Indianapolis for March Madness and they want to stay safe, they want to follow the protocols, but they also want to be part of all of this history? What advice would you give to them?
Don't come. I can't help it, but my mind goes to these images that we've seen over the last few days of Miami Beach in spring break. Now, I know that's not what's happening in Indianapolis, but I do know that just reading the Indianapolis papers of some of the problems that have already occurred in Indianapolis in terms of fans getting together at bars and restaurants and without masks, without social distancing in crowds. You know, we've learned over the last century what are called how to control pandemics without high-tech science. And they're called non-pharmaceutical interventions or NPIs. And they really come down to three basic things for a respiratory spread pandemic. One is wear a mask all the time. Two is social distance. And three is don't get together in crowds. Those three things are fundamental and they're necessary to control this pandemic. And I think it's important to keep in perspective, where are we with this pandemic? We came off of a just horrific December and January. Just one day was a greater tragedy than the other with this pandemic. And then we had 9 straight weeks of a dramatic decline here in the United States, which was we were all so grateful to see. But the last 3 weeks, we've seen a leveling off in terms of the numbers of cases here in the United States. And in the last week, beginning on the 21st, we've seen a 5% increase in cases in the United States. And in the last week, 30 of the 50 states in the United States have shown an increase in the number of cases. And so we're about where we are right now. Where we are is about where we were at the right around the time of the surge in the summer, the end of July. So it's not like we're in great shape, even though we've had 9 weeks of a decline. We're nowhere near where we should be to control this pandemic. The number of cases per 100,000, even in Indianapolis, are too high. We're not in a safe place. And then, of course, on top of all of this, we have the fundamental concern about variants, in particular B.1.1.7, the variant originally from the United Kingdom that wreaked such havoc there. Fortunately, our vaccines work, the immunity we get from our vaccines work very well against it, but it's about 50% more transmissible, and it may be more virulent. 50% more transmissible, and it is becoming and will be probably within the next very few weeks the dominant strain here in the United States. Practically every state has found B.1.1.7. So bringing it back to our question, we're having March Madness occur in one city, and we're bringing people from all over the country here at a time when we're still have far too many cases per 100,000 to rest comfortably. at a time when the cases in the majority of the states are increasing, not decreasing, and at a time when we have a variant spreading rapidly throughout the United States that is 50% more transmissible. It just doesn't seem prudent to me to have an event that we all love, and I'm a big fan of college basketball and college football and sports in general, but it just doesn't seem prudent to me to be bringing fans in to one city at this time of the pandemic.
What about the argument that, you know, the weather's better, people are outside, they'll be more spread out, it's not going to be as if it's being held in the middle of winter?
Right. I think those things really help. The middle of winter, people are congregated inside. The low humidity of winter probably favors viral transmission. So those are positive things. But I'll remind you and the listeners that it was 1 month from now when New York City, in even better weather, came on the brink of just a, I don't know, it already was experiencing a disaster, so something worse than a disaster, where they nearly ran out of ventilators, they nearly ran out of oxygen, and they clearly ran out of hospital beds, and they ran out of morgues. So although seasonality does play a role in this virus and its transmission in our species, seasonality is not a profound modifier of it, as we know not only from April in New York, but we know from the summer throughout the United States.
So I guess as we get ready to wrap up here, to sum up, your advice to folks is maybe just watch the game on TV.
Stay home and watch the game on TV. I think that having the games played, it's a minuscule risk, a very small risk, with the efforts that have been put into making them safe for everybody. But I just don't think people should be coming to Indianapolis at this time. And I think they should be watching it on television at home and enjoying the games.
All right. Well, thank you so much, John, for joining us. We really appreciate it. John Swartzberg is a clinical professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you to you and all of our guests for taking the time to speak with us today. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like to hear a repeat of this show or any past show, listen to them anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation on juvenile justice and reaction to Governor Eric Holcomb's address this evening on where Indiana stands in the fight against COVID-19. And don't forget, you can always connect with us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.